speaking to audiences around the world and historic battles and events. Lectures and mentoring have been an inspiration in my life, and as we were talking at dinner, never bring your notes out on the battlefield when you're doing a lecture, because when the wind blows, they fly away, and then you have no notes. I always remember that one. During World War II, Ed served with distinction in the U.S. Marine Corps, first with the 3rd Marine Raider Battalion, commanded by Colonel Harry the Horse Lever Sledge, and later with the 7th Marine Regiment. While serving with the latter unit, he was severely wounded at Cape Gloucester on the Isle of New Britain. Following a convalescence period of 26 months, he entered Georgetown University, and after attending an undergraduate degree at the institution, Ed spent 3 years working at the U.S. Naval Hydrographic Office at Suvarnabhumi. He later enrolled at Indiana University, where he received a master's degree in history. 1955, Ed joined the National Park Service and worked his way up the promotion ladder to become the chief historian of the National Park Service. In that position, he gained respect in innumerable congressmen and members of the executive branch, and following his retirement in 1998, Ed began a well-sought-after guest speaking tour in battlefields Americans have fought from the French and Indian War through World War II. Let's give him a big hand and welcome. Thank you.
Now, I'm going to pick up about 5:30 in the morning on July 2nd. The Confederates had done well by the end of day one. It had been touch and go till about mid-afternoon on day one, but in the end, it looked like the Confederates were on the verge of one of their great victories that they will have in the war. Lee had arrived on the battlefield about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He was undoubtedly somewhat disturbed to find that a battle was taking place at Gettysburg, because A.B. Hill and Harry Heath had disobeyed his orders, word that he did not want to bring on a battle until his entire army was concentrated on Cashtown Gap. But they brought one on. It becomes a meeting engagement, and Hill will not be doing well at noon. But with the arrival of Ewell will trump the 11th Corps, which also arrives, and there's an important meeting on the grounds of the seminary. Lee had arrived there earlier, about 4 o'clock, and General Longstreet arrived about 5 o'clock. And Lee has troubles getting his army to function. We have the value of hindsight. We would know today that Lee, when he reorganized his corps, his army, following the Battle of Jacksonville, and he would have done it anyway if Jackson had lived. But that would have, he would have been, only have to choose one new corps commander. But with the death of Jackson, he picks two new corps commanders. And at Gettysburg, the two new corps commanders will be weighed and found wanting. And they will not follow up or undertake operations that might have seen, and all Confederate veterans will remember, if Jackson had just been there, we would have occupied Culp's Hill, and the Union would not have been there in the morning. And that's the tenor of the arguments that General Longstreet and General Lee are going to have. General Lee will argue that if the enemy is there in the morning, and there I mean to attack him, and there I will beat him or he will beat me. So that's why it becomes so important of the failure of Ewell and A.P. Hill late on the afternoon and into the early evening to rest on their laurels and make no effort to follow up. General Longstreet will not like what he sees. He sees the Union have a very strong position on the high ground, a much stronger position than Lee had at Antietam. To make matters worse, the Union have the interior position. And Meade has decided that he's going to Gettysburg and his troops are going to concentrate at Gettysburg. That will require General Sedgwick camped near Manchester to make a Herculean 32-mile march between dusk on the first. And he'll be on the field by 2 o'clock on the afternoon of the second. Longstreet remembers better than Lee what had happened at Fredericksburg. We know the most quoted statements that Lee will make during the entire Civil War is during the mid-afternoon of the 13th day of December, when it says, "War as the Union troops attack 8 times against the high ground at Willis Hill." He will say, "It is good that war is so terrible, or we would go too far of it." Now remember whose men are getting the S shot out of them. It's not the Confederates. Now Longstreet sees it in a different way, because he's closer to the scene. It's his men that are holding Willis Hill and the high ground. And he'll remark, "If the Union continue to attack me there, I'll kill every man in the Army of the Potomac." So he has come away with a different opinion. As he looks at the Union incision, resting on Culp's Hill, the famous fish hook, the barb, going around the curve and down the shank. The shank at that time ends near the Pennsylvania Monument, because General Sickles will not arrive on the field till after 10 a.m. And General Longstreet will say, if he's there in the morning, we'd better leave him alone. And I think that we would be better obliged to move to the south, and south of Big Round Top, and move down into Maryland and occupy the position Meade would have occupied if he had not found Gettysburg a place he should fight a battle. And that's the Pipe Creek line. And Longstreet's argument is, we'll move down into Maryland, take position along what the Union was calling the Pipe Creek line, and let them attack us. Lee will say, no, the enemy's there in the morning, I'm going to attack him. Now the people who will criticize Longstreet could have done it, we'll never know. Now one thing that Lee has to worry about, Jeb Stuart, he doesn't know where he is. He hasn't heard from Jeb Stuart since the 25th day of June. But he knows by the evening, the early morning hours of the 29th, the Union Army is north of the Potomac River and concentrated in and around Frederick. So Lee has cavalry with him. He has a brigade commanded by Albert Gallatin Jenkins. But Albert Gallatin Jenkins is much more attuned to partisan warfare in Western Virginia. So there are some cavalry with him, but not used to operating with the army. And also, they know something neither Lee or Longstreet doesn't know. They don't know that by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, General Sedgwick will be on the field and going in camp on the Baltimore Pike, down there where it crosses Rock Creek, where he would be in a good position to counter Longstreet's move. So in the morning, both of them are up early, both Lee and Longstreet, and Lee is going to send his chief engineer, Captain Johnston, out to make a reconnaissance. Now Johnston in the 1890s is going to say he got up on Big Round Top and the Round Top. But that's in the 1890s. It's had a long time to reflect over. Most people are going to say he probably gets on Bushman Knoll. And at that time, he comes back with the same information that Lee has, that he obtains from his command post and the headquarters near the seminary, that the Union Army's left flank extends no further south than the Pennsylvania Monument. And that only occurs when General Hancock arrives on the field about 6:15. Sickles will be arriving about 10 o'clock. And when he arrives, he will take position on the right, on the left of General Hancock, on Cemetery Ridge, and he'll extend his left southward to the area of the Millertown Road or Wheatfield Avenue. He only has two divisions in his corps. He had three divisions in his corps at the Battle of Chancellorsville. His division had taken, his corps had taken in a, taken a heavy losses at Chancellorsville. His division is much weaker than it was before. And Sickles got along with General Hooker. They were like Damien and Pythias. But Meade, the new commander of the Army of the Potomac, who takes command on the morning of the 28th, has no use for General Sickles. Neither as a soldier, nor as a person. He looks at General Sickles the same way you people look at O.J. Simpson, a man who had murdered or entrapped his wife's lover and then killed her, killed him, and had walked. So they do not communicate at all. Sickles also remembers something from Chancellorsville besides. The key moment, this gentleman was at Chancellorsville, on the morning of the 3rd, General Hooker, General Sickles holds Hazel Grove, the best artillery position in the area. And Hooker will order him off. Sickles will argue no. Hooker will repeat it. And he'll pull his men off Hazel Grove, thus giving the Confederates key to the battle. So Sickles, when he moves into position with his left anchored on Wheatfield Avenue, that leaves the only people on top of Little Round Top. Now, up to 7:30 in the morning, Geary's division of the 12th Corps had been up there. But Geary had been pulled off Little Round Top and sent over to join his parent unit, General Slocum, on Galt's Hill. So Johnson will go out, and he notices the same thing that Lee did. The Union line extends no further south than the Pennsylvania Monument. And then Lee has his plan. Now, at Chancellorsville, the Confederates had knowledge of the Furnace Road. They had the use of the young Walter boy. And they knew there was a road going from the area of the final meeting place. And they knew this road was generally not visible from the Union line. But Johnson had not reconnoitered the roads that Longstreet is going to have to move on. Also, there are no contoured maps. That's a luxury you do not have if you're in a civil war. So they only show high ground with hatchers. And all hatchers, they'll show high ground, but they don't tell how high they are. So Lee has his plan. And it is the same plan that he used when he had two perfect matched corps commanders. Each with strong points And the strong points usually complemented the weak point of the other corps commander. Now he has two corps commanders who had not done well on day one. In fact, one of them is not feeling well. That's why the women, no woman here would lust for APL. APL had bad luck at West Point in his final year. Evidently, they didn't have lectures then. Nice armed services were, and every month we got a lecture. You don't get gonorrhea from the toilet seat or the doorknob. One way. Evidently, they didn't tell A.P. Hill and the cadets. They must not, because George Armstrong Custer also came down to gonorrhea at West Point. Let's hope they didn't get it from the same woman. Custer is in 59. Hill is in 46. That's why it takes him another year to get to West Point. He has the added addition that caused severe adhesion and that duct that carries the urine from your kidneys to where you get rid of it. And everybody who's had a kidney stone knows it hurts badly. That's another problem that A.P. Hill is going to have. As they're doing it, there's going to be some pop. According to General McLaws will be the guiding person as they move southward. And since the Union left only extends to the Pennsylvania Monument, McLaws, at the end of the march they're going to take, is to deploy his men astride the Emmitsburg Road and attack up the Emmitsburg Road like this. And when they're doing it, Longstreet's explaining where he wants him, and Lee comes up and more or less takes over and says, you will deploy your division there, and points it out on the map, which is not good when you have two strong-willed men having a rather hot discussion. Longstreet will then say, one of my brigades is not with me. And it belongs to General Hood, division, my best division commander. General Law had slept at New Guilford, Pennsylvania, which is very close to Chambersburg. Longstreet will tell General Lee, I don't like to go into action with one boot off. I want to wait for General Law's brigade. So if you're Law's brigade, before you step off on the great attack, you will have already marched 24 miles between 2 a.m. and 3 p.m. Lee says, good. So now it's going to be a period of waiting. Now Lee is going as Muhammad. He's going to the mountain. He will never hold a staff meeting during the Battle of Gettysburg, in which he gets General Hill, who he's going to stay with, because Lee knows Hill has serious problems. He doesn't know exactly what they are. And Ewell is having trouble because he had his right leg amputated, and they had to do a resection on him and take more bone off. And of course, that means they shorten the leg, and he has, he can, when he stands, he has to use crutches. So he's not very mobile. So Lee will ride with his certain members of his staff, and he will leave the area of his headquarters, in that area here, Seminary Ridge, and ride over to Ewell's headquarters over on Benner's Hill. And he's going to give Ewell his instructions. Again, they're verbal. Ewell is going to keep his men well in hand and be ready when he hears Longstreet's guns roar into action. And when he hears it, his artillery will open fire from Benner's Hill, and everything looks good. He will assail the Union right. Lee returns from his meeting with General Ewell about 12:30. And arriving at that time, having left at 2 from New Guilford, is General Law's brigade. And the Confederates move off. Now they're going to be along Camp Bosta. Hood's men, except for Law, will arrive, and McLaws are along Willoughby Run. They hope to move southward and keep Hare Ridge, which is to the west of Willoughby Run, between them and the Union signal stations. When they move off, General McLaws takes the lead, since, according to Lee's plan, he will, as he approaches Seminary Ridge, he's going to approach it in this area and form his men astride the Emmitsburg Road and attack up the Emmitsburg Road. And the premise is that the Union left extends no further south than that. The premise is they do not know that Sickles has arrived. Off they go. Longstreet is riding with General Hood, the 2nd Division in line. And they move out. And at about 2 o'clock, they're going to cross Hare Ridge, about 2 miles west of the Union signal station on the Roundup. And as they do, McLaws rides up on the ridge, and I can see the Union signal station on the Roundup. That means if they can see me, I can see them. So he gets, so Longstreet comes forward, and Longstreet says, we're going to countermarch. The Confederates are going to get a big bargain on the countermarch. Because what they're going to do northward, go up, keep Hare Ridge, which runs along Marsh Creek, separating from Willoughby Run, and go northward and cross Hare Ridge at this low point, where they're seen by the Signal Corps people. They see them going, and which way do they see them going? To the north and east. They come through a saddle, and the Signal Corps people will send a message to Meade. The enemy is moving north, and Meade will then focus till 4 o'clock, Meade expects the attack to begin in this area. So Longstreet really gets the bargain. He didn't plan to get it, because when his men turn south, they come down Willoughby Run, cross Fairfield Road here, go down here, and cross the and will turn east at this point. Now the Wheatfield Road at that time, after it leaves the Beech Orchard, comes over here. Meanwhile, Sickles has problems. His problems are that from his new position on Hancock's left, with his 10,000 men, they only extend the Villatown Road. So you'll ask, tell me, I've got troubles. I have higher ground in front of me. The Emmitsburg Road is on higher ground than Cemetery Ridge. As it goes south, it falls in elevation until it comes to the saddle here, and then it rises up to Little Round Top. Then you have the gorge between Little Round Top and Big Round Top. George Meade makes a big mistake. Who does he send down to talk to Sickles? And he'd had a terrible argument the previous day, Meade and Sickles. Meade doesn't like to deal with him. And George comes down, and young George and Sickles explains his problem. And George goes back and sees Papa and tells him what Sickles' problem is. Now, Papa sends the best artillerist in America. I hate to make any of you good Confederates mad at me, because any person here, man or woman, in this audience would be a better chief of artillery than the Episcopal, and I hope he's a good Episcopal minister. That's William Nelson Pettler. That's the worst matchup you could have. So Hunt comes down, and Sickles and he ride out to the Peach Orchard. Sickles looks very proud of himself. Isn't this higher ground than where I was on Seminary Ridge. Hunt says, yes. Is it a better artillery position? Yes. Can I move my men up here? No. I don't have the authority. The only man who can give you authority is General Meade. As Hood and McLaws were making their march, General Anderson's division, again, Lee has made an error. Anderson reports to Hill. When he attacks, it will be an echelon in support of Longstreet. Now you've got a man that is not feeling well, and that means that Anderson, a weak man, will be a little hesitant on taking orders from General Longstreet. What Lee should have done is attach Anderson to Longstreet, but he doesn't. So as Anderson extends his right flank southward down Seminary Ridge, in Pitzer's Woods there's a clash. Now, they have a trouble. Now, the first U.S. sharpshooters in our day would be like special forces or rangers. Their ability had been neutralized by Hiram Berdan, your leader. When you put a leader leading elites, and he's a coward, that's not a good thing. So he's not with them. And as they run into the Are you here? They have trouble with Wilcox's Alabamians. They yell for reinforcements. They send the 3rd Maine down there, and they're still pounding them. So that means later Verdun and Sickles will collude to say they're clashing with Longstreet. You're an underrated BS. They're battling Wilcox's Alabamians. Now, Sickles is now getting nervous. And about 3 o'clock, he decides, in essence, screw the snapping turtle. This is cadet days at West Point. And he orders his 10,000 man corps to leave their position along Cemetery Ridge, with their left flank anchored on the Millertown Road, and their rank right on Hancock's left near the Pennsylvania Monument. Now the staff officers think it looks good as Sickles advances his 10,000 men. Men's playing, flags snapping in the breeze, and as Hancock recalls it, he tells them, I think they're going to come, don't applaud them, because they're going to come tumbling back much faster and with less parade than when he went out. Now, about 3 o'clock, a clause comes up here on the crest of Cemetery Ridge, and who does he see in the peace orchard? So now move to the next map. The next map that we would show, the next map is the assumed position of the Union line. This is the assumed position of the Union line. Now the next map. We'll come back. Now, what is it? There's the Emmitsburg Road. There's the Peach Orchard. Sickles' other position is Cemetery Ridge. So he's matched his men and attacked and occupied the famed Sagent. And on the right is Goggle Eye, a Humphreys division that extends from near the Cadore Barn down the Emmitsburg Road to Trostel Lane. From Trostel Lane to the Peach Orchard will be a brigade of the division commanded by D.B. Birney. Another one of Birney's brigades will go like this and like this. That's Sickles Salient. This is Hawks Ridge. This, of course, is the Devil's Den, Hawks Ridge. There's the signal station. And there is Little Roundtop's Crest, and there is Big Roundtop's Crest. Now, the only man more surprised than General Meade is going to be General McLaws, because the position where he's supposed to deploy his men astride the Emmitsburg Road is occupied by Yankees. Now there's going to be another argument. This argument is going to be between Longstreet and McLaws. Eventually, your great-grandfather, when you go to East Tennessee, will fire McLaws. McLaws is astounded. He goes and they call Longstreet up. Now, Longstreet knows he cannot do what Lee said. So what he's going to do now, he is going to form General Hood on the right. And General Hood will then be astride the Emmitsburg Road. A lot, if it had been the other way, if Sickles had not advanced, we would have McLaws astride the Emmitsburg Road. So Hood is astride the Emmitsburg Road. With two brigades, this man in his bad knee has been keeping up with them. He's one of Law's men. He's already now marched 24 miles. And you've had a tough sergeant, and he ain't let you fill your canteen. And there's where you are. There's Law's brigade. There is Beverly Robertson's brigade, known to the Texans and Arkansans as Aunt Polly. Why do you call him Aunt Polly? He's a prohibitionist. And these Texans think they're the best at making out with the women, the best fighters, and can drink everybody under the table. Harry Hayes is Louisiana's that are going to say BS. We're better than all three of those characteristics, licking Yankees, making out with the women, and drinking than you. Those two Western brigades are big enemies of each other, friendly enemies. So they're going to argue back and forth, Hood and Longstreet. Hood will finally get Major Fairfax. Now, Major Fairfax, now Lee, I hate to go saying it, would rather hang around Longstreet's headquarters than Jackson's. He found Jackson's headquarters rather boring. As they talk about their military operations, they're going to talk about predestination and various theories of the Presbyterian Church. Now, Major Fairfax, from down in Prince William County, sets a good table for Longstreet and his staff. There are good wines there, good conversation, and Lee likes to go to Longstreet's headquarters. I've just made enemies of all Jackson's people. So he even sends Major Fairfax to argue his case. But Longstreet will say, General Lee says we'll attack up the Emmitsburg Road, and we will. So Hood is now going to have to advance up the Emmitsburg Road and keep astride of it. Now it's around 4 o'clock. Meade has called a staff meeting, and now he knows what Sickles has done, but he's going to play it cool. But Sickles is going to show up rather late for the staff meeting. And Meade has asked, what's been wrong? What you've been doing? He says, I've advanced my corps up the Emmitsburg Road. And the snapping turtle explodes. You've done what? Sickles can see that Meade, he stored up a hornet's nest. And then he's going to say, should I withdraw my corps? Meade will then snap at him, the enemy won't let you. Because at that moment, the enemy signal guns have gone boom, 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 as the Royal Artillery opens up and the Confederates are going to advance. Meade responds rather rapidly. Sickles, rejoin your command. Sickles will rejoin his command very, very fast. Meade will then ride over to the 5th Corps, which is in reserve. The 5th Corps is off the map, off in there. You're near Rock Creek. And he'll go to his new George Sykes, who is commanding the 5th Corps. And this is a good day for the Union, because George ain't going to be tidy this day. And he immediately issues the orders to James Barnes, commander of one of his divisions. Barnes, he tells you, get your men over to the Peach Orchard as fast as you can. The only thing I can say good about General Barnes is graduated the same class from West Point that Lee did. Militarily, I can think this is his last battle in the war. So off goes General Barnes with his brigade, with his division, and when he arrived in the area of the of Rose's wheat field, we'll pick him up then. Now, meanwhile, the Confederates have started moving. Now, the Confederates have bad luck. God is not on their side this day. The most important man right now, next to General Longstreet, with the army's right, is General Hood. Because Hood, undoubtedly, since he's not going to be permitted to go south of Big Round Top with his entire corps, he's going to have Law's brigade move forward. Meanwhile, Meade has also sent Governor Kay Warren to Little Round Top. Warren is horrified when he gets there and sees a score of Signal Corps people up there. Anyone here could yell boo and have Little Round Top right now. And the Confederates are coming. Now, Law's brigade has bad luck. They haven't filled their canteens since leaving New Guilford. So while they're waiting, the regimental commanders are going to send a score of men each out of five regiments. A score, and just short of this strength, by 100 men over here to the current place to fill their canteens. And meanwhile, the signal guns are fired. They're not going to get their canteens, and they're short 100 men as they move forward. Now the area. In the last 5 years, the area here has been restored. You used to stand here at the Alabama Monument and you could not see House Ridge. You could just barely see Little Round Top. You could not see the Devil's Den, but now you can from there. As they move off, Warren has got up there and he says, we need men up there. So he's joined by his brother-in-law, future brother-in-law, Roebling, who built the Brooklyn Bridge, and Captain McKenzie. And they ride over here where the 4th New York Battery is, and tell them to open fire. Boom, boom, boom! And who do they take out? John Bell Hood, as he passes the Bushman property. So almost the first Confederate casualty in the big attack is a man most important. And Law is not going to be a very good replacement for General Hood. In fact, Law's brigade, Hood will, with Law in command of the division, they're going to lose command control of it. So they're going to send let's see the next map. All right, here they come. There's Law. Law's breaking up. Think if Law had hit Little Round Top with 27 with almost 2,000 men. We wouldn't have heard of Governor K. Warren being there first. We wouldn't have heard of Strong Vincent. But instead, the 15th Alabama and 47th Alabama are going to advance like this. They're going to chase the sharpshooters of the 2nd U.S. sharpshooters up over the top of Big Round Top. Now, the 44th and 48th Alabama are soon going to be going like this. with no one in command, they're fragmented, they're going to advance up Rose Run and go into the Devil's Den. Think of those four regiments. Could have hit the Roundup, you would have never heard of Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, and all the ladies would walk out of me now. Now, the 4th Alabama will go like that, and will come up against Little Round Top, right there. They will be joined by the 4th and the 5th Texas. Now, the 1st Texas and the 3rd Arkansas will try to keep their left flank astride the Emmitsburg Road. Robinson's trying to do it, but he can't do it, as the 1st Texas and the 3rd Arkansas shear off this way here. In support are going to be, here's where they were filling their canteens. They're never going to get back. That means if you're in the 15th and those Arkansas and those Alabama regiments, you're going to be loose out of the brigade 100 men in your canteens. So then Rock Benning will follow the route taken generally by the 1st Texas and the 3rd Arkansas in to the triangular field. And when they commit Anderson and his 5 Georgia regiments, they will go that way. So they have lost command and control. So piecemeal, they'll attack the Union forces. Now, reaching here in the wheat field, luckily, Strong Vincent is there. Luckily, they don't see General Marmers. Because when Roebling and McKenzie come up, they'll say, Colonel Vincent, he's a Harvard man. He's a martinet. Worst of the worst West Point martinets. And they go tell Strong Vincent, we need your brigade now up on Little Round Top. And off they go for Little Round Top. They'll come up the back side of it. And when they come up the back side of Little Round Top, there'll be the 20th Maine on the left, then the 83rd Pennsylvania, then the Crazy Rice in the 44th New York, and on the right, the 16th Michigan. And the Confederates are going to hit them piecemeal. And what's going to happen, they're going to throw the Confederates back in their first 2 attacks. By this time, the Confederates have driven the Yankees from House Ridge. More men coming up, and a better fresh Union brigade commanding by Stephen Weed, another brigade commander out of the 5th Corps. He's out of the division commanded by General Ayers. And they'll arrive up here. It will be a bloody contest, but the Union will hold. Now, the bad thing you discover, you get too involved, and I get some dirty looks when I'm with the 20th Maine, because it seems that Joshua Chamberlain shouldn't have written his book when Lieutenant Melcher and Lieutenant Fisker, Major Fisker alive, and they said, we didn't hear that charge. It's all serendipity. In other words, Chamberlain's veracity is being called into Bless you. But they do hold, and the Union will not seize, the Confederates will not seize the Roundup. In fact, that's the only place on the Union left until you get up to the angle that the Confederates don't hold by 6 o'clock that evening. And I would say General Longstreet is right when he says the next 2 hours is going to be the finest fighting that he'll see under any Confederate unit during the war. As the fight, so the Union are going to hold Little Round Top. Now in the fighting in the wheat field, it'll start off with men from Barnes' brigade, Tilton and Schweitzer's brigade, and they're going to beat them up. The Union are going to rush in. Hancock is now having to send men down. Caldwell will come down successively with 4 brigades. Edward Cross, as he moves out, a tough man, 39 years old, wounded badly. He led the regiment in the Union Army that has the most KIs in the war is the 5th New Hampshire. As they move out, Cross is a particularly favorite of Hancock, and he'll call to Cross, "Colonel Cross, this is your last battle without a star." Cross evidently has a feeling of death. He normally was like a motorcycle driver. The Army tied a red bandana, as bald as a head as I am, but this day he's wearing a black bandana as he leads his men forward. Yes, he will die, but he will slow. He'll throw in Zook's brigade of Caldwell's division. Zook is soon dead, and his men are borne back. Irish brigade will go forward, just a shadow of its old self. Again, as you see that monument up there, you'll see an identical monument when you go to Notre Dame. There you'll see Father Corby standing on a rock, laying to the side with his hat and his gloves, and more effective than Newt Rockney, a Lutheran, who wins games in the 20s by winning one for the giver. Corby is even better. As he's going to, when they advance their gold and green flags, I can see Mackinac there kneeling down as he gives them absolution. And then we'll warn them, cowardice in the face of the enemy will internally damn you. That's better than winning one for the giver. And finally, they will throw in their final brigade. They'll be all chewed up. Ayres will throw in 2 brigades, and they will be beaten up. And the fight continues. Entering into the fight for the wheat field, will be 2 successive brigades from McLaws' division. First, the brigade commanded by Joe Kershaw, and then the brigade commanded by Paul Sims. They're knocking off the brigade commanders fast as Paul Sims goes down. Barksdale is like a berserker as he prepares to advance toward the peach orchard. He has within the 13th, 17th, 9th, 13th, 17th, 18th, and 21st Mississippi. while a member of the House of Representatives. One of the famous brawls they had, they carried more than invective then. Into the halls of Congress and the House, they carried brass knucks, knives, and everything. I can see Nancy Pelosi or Newt Gingrich. I don't think he would do any better. Now, when Congressman Gooch is announced denouncing the Southerners in 1856, Elliot Washburn comes up and sucker punches him for in the rear. Barksdale turns on him with a roar as everybody crowds around, pummeling each other. They're getting a little humor out there, because I think Freeman has to be wrong when he describes Barksdale advancing at 6:15. He'll say his hair is treading behind him. Well, they found a better way to put a rug on by 1860 than they know now. Barksdale wore a rug. Can you imagine the State Journal of the House describing the fight and Barksdale getting his rug knocked off? So Barksdale, supported by Wofford, will go forward and they'll sweep the Union troops out of the Peach Orchard. Barksdale will be like a berserker as he drives forward toward the final Union line. At the head of the 21st Mississippi and the 39th New York will have a whole company of men shoot at Barksdale. They'll riddle him. He'll be taken to a hospital and die. Wilcox and Law and Succession go forward as Anderson takes up the charge. Five times Humphreys will halt his men as they fall back. Five times they break. And when they reach the area near the Minnesota Monument, they cannot reform again. Now Hancock is a lot different. Lee is very unperturbed. Anderson is no Hancock. Hill is less. Wilcox's men have advanced a mile. They reach the upper reaches of Trostle Hollow Ravine. They then halt. Reform and go on the next 200 yards. The only troops between them and the crest of Cemetery Hill, the battery of guns, Thomas's battery, and the 1st Minnesota. 262 strong. Hancock will look at them and call for them and tell the colonel, I want you to charge those people who have stopped in reforming. The colonel says, no, you mean it? I have 262 men. Hancock says, yes. And the 262 Minnesotans go forward with fixed bayonets. As you will be there, you can see the Minnesota Monument. You can see the fence that separates them from the Trostle Woods. Cross that line and come within 40 yards of the 1,000 Alabamians who are wrestling. They'll fire a volley and charge. The Alabamans will be thrown into dismay. The Minnesotans fall back, having lost 82% of their men. Wilcox will ask for support from Anderson. Anderson will reply, persevere, things will get better. Wilcox is a salty man. Imagine he discussed Anderson's brains and courage, but no men come. Hill stands and watches. Lee does not intervene. And Wright's men surge forward, Georgia boys. They cross the Emmitsburg Road. They sweep by the Cadore house and barn, overrun Brown's battery, reach the regular monument, and there's no one advancing on their left. Hancock is everywhere as he's ordering up the 1st, the 10th New York, ordering up those fellows who were down in South Fairfax County. Those men that left here, down in southern Fairfax County, on this morning of the 26th, the Vermont Brigade. These men are all going to be out of the service in three weeks. The 13th, Vermont will be there as Hancock orders them forward. The Confederates are going to have to abandon the capture batteries they call on and fall back. Billy Mahone, who might have been a good general in 64, does not advance. Nor does Carnot Posey. They belong to Anderson. Anderson should have been kicking butt or doing something. On their left, Pender will go forward, be cut down by artillery fire, and the Confederates' last chance of winning the Battle of Gettysburg have now passed. You can see why Longstreet would write that in that 2.5 hours fighting, his men fought the best fight he saw. Ewell will, because of an acoustical shadow, it'll be 7 o'clock before Ewell moves against Culp's Hill. Again on Culp's Hill, the Confederates come close. Up on Cemetery Hill, Harry Hayes's 5 Louisiana regiments and Isaac Avery's 3 North Carolina regiments reach Cemetery Hill, capture 6 Union guns, and Jubilee does nothing to support them. The Confederates seem to be paralyzed. And the Union again, with Hancock on center stage, counterattacks and they leave those Confederates who got up on Cemetery Ridge to talk of what might have been at the reunions thereafter. They also seize a toehold on Culp's Hill. So there will be a third day at Gettysburg. But in many ways, on the third day at Gettysburg, they do what I got warned long ago when I was a Marine Corps. When you gamble with the big boys, don't send good money after bad. You're going to lose more yet. So that's the story in brief of the third day of the second day of Gettysburg. Now, if you could get a breakdown of casualties between day 1, day 2, and day 3, Harry Fonts, who wrote the definitive book on Longstreet's attack, will argue that if they did that and broke him down by day, Antietam would not be the bloodiest day in American history. It'll be the second day of July at Gettysburg. Thank you for your attention, and I will address any questions. Better than usual. was watching the clock. I know we have to get out of here by 9, so I take a couple of questions. Usually I don't have time. Since I probably insulted some people, you know, I probably got some things in there.
So, by and large, as they're moving along, other than the fact that they didn't make the LeBron sign, they're moving successfully. They're breaking further and further as you're going through one league tour until you finally get the AD Hillsborough, and then it just stops.
Yeah. So the Confederates capture everything south of the regular line, except LeBron. And the attack is functioning very well until you get to Anderson's command, and you get Posey will advance one regiment up to the Emmitsburg Road. His other three regiments halt well short of the Emmitsburg Road. Mahone does not advance at all. Hancock is using everything he can lay his hand on counterattack. So Meade doesn't really have to worry much. And of course, the Confederate leadership is failing the tough task. If Hill can't do it, Lee is right there. Lee is never more than a couple hundred yards from Hill. Hill is never more than 200 yards from Anderson. So there's a failure of Confederate command. There's one excuse they have. Someone should have taken it. When they know that when Pender is mortally wounded, they know he lost a half a dozen men out of his division. And when he's mortally wounded, all energy goes out of Pender's division. And of course, I always like to say early, he has two brigades. And those two brigades that get onto Cemetery Ridge and capture 6 guns belong to his. John Brown Gordon's in the area. He knows a lot of criticizing. Why doesn't he advance?
How much of what Hancock threw down to the south there was holding, did he later have available to throw up against Colesville?
Hancock is pretty well. The Union have thrown everybody of the reserves on the Round Top. There are 2 brigades of the 6th Corps on the Round Top. And they have stripped Slocum's Corps, which is on Tops Hill. Slocum will go down to the Round Top. And when he goes, he'll take one division with him and then order his other division under Geary to go down. And they get lost. So Geary is the same as not doing anything, because when he's ordered to go around top, he goes down the Baltimore Pike and never gets there. So they've reduced the force on Culp's Hill of the 12th Corps from six brigades to 1 brigade. So you guys get the Confederates, their toehold up there. Yeah.
Why didn't George Meade court-martial Dan Sickles for his movement?
Well,
we're
undoubtedly
so many troops.
All right, why do you court-martial him? Who's the first man from Gettysburg to arrive in Washington?
Sickles.
Personally been on the field. Now, Sickles is even a better man than our friend John. His leg is amputated on them about midnight on the 2nd day of July. He is evacuated to Baltimore on the 3rd day of July. He'll be in Washington in his former quarters on Lafayette Square. Who visits him at the quarters on Lafayette Square on the belt? the most important man in the United States, George Gordon Meade, and his hyperactive son, I can just see the scene. The great man sitting in an easy chair with his right leg bandaged up above the knee. And if you've been wounded badly, you know you drain pus and syrup. I can see the bandages are all blood-stained, and Sickles will tell them, if I had not advanced my corps up to the Emmitsburg Road, he's telling it to the most important man in the United States, and General Meade would have retreated on the night of the 2nd. So he sold his story to the most important man. Then on the 7th, Meade makes a horrible mistake. All, even major generals, I think, have press officers now, don't they? They didn't have them then. And Meade drafts a congratulatory order to his troops. This is on the 7th. We're winning the battle. We're defeating the enemy. And then calls on them for further exertion to drive the invaders from our soil. And Lincoln explodes. Drive invaders from our soil? What's the man thinking? It's all our soil. Of course, Meade, when he pursues, does right. Lincoln doesn't really understand. Meade has to go to Frederick to resupply his army. But to Lee, to the president, it looks like he's not pursuing. He has to go to Frederick, draw supplies, and then head east.
He's just going to blow up.
Then what happens next? Meade schedules an attack on Lee's Williamsport line for the 12th. The Union officers, a number of them, get nervous. And they think that Lee does have a strong position. And they're not confident they can break the Union line on the 12th. So they have a council of war. And the council of war will decide and recommend to Meade not to attack. So he doesn't attack. So Lee will then have all day on the 12th, all night on the 12th and 13th, and the president will then have Halleck write Meade and said that, told Meade, you had him in your hand. Oh, you didn't have to clasp him. You didn't do it. Now, Meade, the president never sends that message. If he had, Meade would have now resigned. And then worse on the 7th, the day that Meade says that statement of drive the invaders from our soil, and Lincoln responds to him, what's the man thinking? It's all our soil. He receives a message that Grant had drafted on the morning of the 4th day of July. There's no telegraph short of Cairo, Illinois. So Grant's message of the 4th will not get to Washington until the evening of the 7th. And Grant's message will tell of the surrender of John Pemberton and his army of Vicksburg. 30,000 Confederate prisoners, 173 cannon, 60,000 stand of arms, 2 million rounds of ammunition, etc., etc. And Grant and the president read that. And I will guarantee you, at that moment, unless Grant screws up, he's going to be the next general-in-chief of the Army. So it's just the opposite of what he sees me as. Any other questions? Yes?
Yeah, you talked about the casualties on the 2nd. First of all, what do you think? Is Fonz right? Or?
I think he could be. It would be very close. I think maybe Fonz would be right. Because the casualties at Antietam are 23,000. The casualties at Gettysburg are 51,000. The casualties on day one are higher than on day three. There's only one Union, only that 12,200 men that are with Pickett are going to get badly beaten up. And they say two out of every three of them will not come back, so that comes up to about near 7,000.
But the total, looking at the casualty reports on the Union side, they come up with a magic number of 3,155 killed, and they come up with 23,150 wounded, and that comes out on the 4th. Now, I just wonder if they factored in what happened to the 6th U.S. Cavalry south of Battle Field.
I think they probably counted casualties through the 4th of July for the Union in War Department. Well, so they will not count any casualties after the 4th of July.
Oh, the Galway, the 8th Ohio, he's one of the many people you read. He states that the casualties, the real casualties of the 8th Ohio were significantly higher than those that were in the casualty count.
Yes. Well, that's because now they come up and they say the casualties on all battles were much higher than they
really were.
Than they turned in at that time. Yes, General Sickles.
I was going to talk about General Sedgwick. Why wasn't he more actively and effectively?
Well, Sedgwick is a reserve, and he used 1.5 brigades at Little Round Top on day 2, and they will use about four brigades on Culp's Hill on day 3, and then any pursuit at all will be by Sedgwick. But of course, by the time Sedgwick pursues, it's going to be on the 5th. So I would think Meade is still playing it cautiously. Now, Meade has a big plus. Meade's big plus is George Sharp. Now, George Sharp will tell Meade on the morning of the 3rd, Sharp's estimate of the number of Confederates on the field are more accurate than General Lee has.
Wow.
So I would argue, since George Sharp is one of the heroes of the war, I would argue that if George Sharp was the head of the CIA, I'd get thrown in jail for this, on 9/11, I don't think it would have happened. George Sharp's mind is better than any computer.
He had one bad day. He threw about 14 days when he couldn't track Jubal Early's move out to the valley.
Yeah.
They couldn't track that core at all.
What's your opinion, sir, on the argument between Lee and Longstreet on whether they should have... Your opinion on the argument between Lee and Longstreet as to whether they should have attacked or pulled up?
Well, in retrospect, I got hindsight.
Yeah.
I would say that since I know what's going to happen, I would say Longstreet looks better from hindsight. Now, if I was General Lee and had to make the decision, would I have been concerned not having Stuart with me and not even knowing where Stuart is. That's an advantage he has. Also, on the other side, I don't think Meade would actually realize that Sedgwick could march that 32 miles in the hours he does.
You mentioned that Lee had Micah Jenkins brigade with him. Where was Beverly Robinson?
All right.
And Jamal right. Jones?
Wonderful question. Beverly Robinson and Jamal Jones are still in Virginia.
What?
They were, when Stuart went on his ride, he left two men to guard, watch the Confederate rear and watch the gaps. He left Jones and Robertson. Now, Stuart doesn't like either one of them. Unfortunately, when you don't like either one, and you know that Jones is a good man, and Robertson isn't any good, you got to wonder about Stuart then, knowing that Robertson ranks Jones, and you would think that Lee would know the better of the two and could intervene and tell, forget the rank, Jones is in charge. So the worst cavalryman in the army is in charge. So they're not going to arrive on the battlefield of Gettysburg until the evening of the second day of July. When the battle starts, they're still south of the Potomac River. Any other questions?
One comment. A gentleman named Duke Gingrich wrote an alternative history. I don't know if you've read it.
Well, that's why I said. That's why I used. Think of Newt or
there was no Gettysburg address.
The house.
There was no Gettysburg address in his alternative history.
I don't read. I hate to say it, my wife who died about 7 years ago, she liked the book. I can pull back on it. I don't read counterfactuals. Many books that come out now, I can't read all the Civil War books. I only read the Civil War books the personal friends of mine recommend to me, who I'm very confident of. Because with this desktop publishing, there's no way you can read all the Civil War books.
Very good answer.
And of course, many of the with desktop publishing, anyone can publish anything. Before that, they had to go through editorial review before they had desktop publishing, which weeded out a lot of books.
The library will close in 15 minutes.
Well, that's why I rely on friends of mine.
The library will be closed from 10 to 6. If you need to make arrangements for ride home, please do so now. Please take all materials to the checkout desk now. If you need help finding materials, please go to the information desk now. And if you'd like to print from our computers, please do so now. Thank you.
This will be the last question.
Could Lee have done anything to see that the Union people could not have as good a position on Cemetery Hill as they were able to do?
Yes, the Union, the Union position at Gettysburg is stronger than Lee's position at Antietam. Yeah. So I think Lee should have taken that a little bit into his mind, because he was able to defend his position at Antietam because of the terrain, and particularly having the interior position. And at Gettysburg, he knows both on day 2 and 3, he has exterior position, and that's why the Union are able to check him, particularly on the second, as they can move men from their left to the right, center to the right, much faster than Lee can do it. Lee could not move Longstreet to Galt's Hill in less than 6 hours. Got PowerPoint.
Hey, John? That's interesting.
I just keep
coming. I don't.